All right, we started last time looking at the English Civil War, which is a very significant period in the history of the church and the growth of our understanding of certain issues that were very central in those days. And it's not hard to see how the birth of our nation is very clearly tied to the struggles and the wrestling that the Christians and the Puritans in those days did, and how we benefited from their wrestling. And so there is much significance in studying this and understanding what was going on. So the period we're looking at is the end of the 1500s, beginning of the 1600s. And we covered it last time, but James the First of the King James Version era, he did order the translation of the King James Version, but don't get the wrong impression about King James. He's not the kind of guy we want to emulate. He succeeded Elizabeth the First, and Elizabeth had firmly established Protestantism. Sure. And so the Protestants had been established under her reign, and she had had a very long reign. And so really things had stabilized in England through her tenure. But soon after, then James the First succeeded Elizabeth. Soon after James was coronated, Sir Walter Raleigh was brought on charges, trumped up charges of siding with the Roman Catholics to overthrow James the First. Sir Walter Raleigh had been knighted by Elizabeth and was hated by the Spanish due to his involvement in great naval battles where they conquered the Spanish. Walter Raleigh was very involved in those battles, and he was hated by the Spanish because of that. But Raleigh was found guilty and sentenced to death by James. But because at the beginning of his reign he was treading cautiously and not wanting to make too many waves, he held back on the carrying out of the death sentence and just put Sir Walter Raleigh in the Tower of London, so kind of put him in jail. But then in time, James, due to political expediency and his political objectives, began negotiating with Spain about a marriage of his son Charles to the daughter of the Spanish king, Maria Anne. You can imagine how this horrified the people of England. Spain was this very strong Roman Catholic nation, very tight with the Pope, and suddenly James is looking to marry off his heir to a Roman Catholic bastion of faith. Now, you've got to understand the great struggles that had happened and how dangerous that was. So the people of England were horrified. And then in 1618, in the midst of these marriage negotiations, the Spanish insisted that James execute their hated enemy, Sir Walter Raleigh, as a condition of proceeding with the negotiations. And James went ahead, and this execution took place, where an English hero, at the request of Roman Catholic Spain, was put to death. And so you can see the message that's going across to England, the fear that is building in the people, and the turmoil that is going on. In these negotiations over the marriage, it was with Philip III of Spain, he was being instructed by the Pope, who was pushing for there to be toleration of Roman Catholics in England and removing some of the restrictions on Roman Catholicism. So it was really turning back the great strides that Elizabeth had accomplished and that had brought stability to England at the time with respect to these conflicts between these two sides. During those negotiations, both James and Charles, who was involved in them, realized they would never be able to get these changes past Parliament, and so the whole thing broke down with Spain. And as a result of that, in 1621, Parliament petitioned the king to allow his son Charles to only marry a Protestant, and that the laws against Roman Catholicism would be enforced. There were laws blocking them, and they asked the king, please enforce these. James ripped up the petition and dissolved Parliament, informing them not to interfere in matters of royal prerogative, or else they'll be punished. So he laid down the law. That was his mindset. Okay, I'm in charge. I'm not to be questioned. When James I fell ill in 1625, the powerful Duke of Buckingham refused to allow the king's doctors to attend him. Rumors spread that Buckingham and Prince Charles had poisoned the king, and this older Duke of Buckingham became close friends with the young prince. James I died on the 27th of March 1625, and a year later, one of the king's doctors went public with the poison charges against Buckingham. You can read about that in Robertson's book, Tyrannicide Brief. No charge could be brought against the king, although there was this apparent conspiracy between Buckingham and Charles, who was now king. But no charge could be brought against him, because any charge brought against the king would have been seen as treason. And so they accused Buckingham, but said nothing about the king. So that was the mindset, and that was the understanding in those days, because the king was seen to be above the law. Shortly after this, James died. Charles assumed, he was coming to the throne. But shortly after this, he married Henrietta Maria, a French princess and also a Roman Catholic. And when he married her, she was allowed to bring her Roman Catholic priests with her to England so as to attend to her religious needs. And basically, her court was taken over by the Roman Catholics. She even refused to attend the coronation of her husband, Charles I, because it was a Protestant ceremony. And so now you've got this tension and dynamic taking place in the English throne room, basically. Buckingham held high positions in Charles's government and was a very corrupt man. And so successive parliaments sought to try and bring some check on this corruption. They tried to impeach Buckingham and lay their hands on him, but Charles always managed to dissolve Parliament before they could actually bring these charges against him and arrest him, so that he would just dissolve Parliament and it would be gone, and then they'd have to wait for him to call Parliament to set again. And so they were at the mercy of the king in many respects. And so all this is building tension the whole time as to trying to get justice and protection. And he said to the MPs that Parliaments are altogether in my power for their calling, their sitting, and their dissolution. And Charles had been thoroughly indoctrinated by his father in the idea of the divine rights of kings. And he also had inherited his father's loathing of the Puritans. And so he had this natural aversion to the Puritans. Now, Charles didn't like Parliament, but this dislike of Parliament turned to hatred in 1628 when Buckingham was murdered by a man who claimed to be motivated by the charges brought against him by the House of Commons. Okay, so you had Parliament trying to charge Buckingham. This other individual just carried out the law in his own hands, killed Buckingham, and said, no, because of all these charges that could never be pressed against Buckingham, I killed him. And so the king now blamed Parliament for even raising issues with his favorite friend. The death of Buckingham was celebrated throughout England with the ringing of bells and huge bonfires and celebrations, which something the king would never forgive. Charles now vowed that he would not allow Parliament to meet except for the purpose of voting him money. That was kind of in the books in England. The only way the king could get his money was through Parliament accepting, voting on it and deciding, yes, we'll grant this money. So that was kind of the check on him. So he said, now you've got no other purpose than I'll call you when I need money. And he said Parliament would not be allowed to criticize his foreign policy or to speak up for the liberty of his subjects, either by objecting to his power to imprison them or by dissenting from the arrangements he chose to make for their Anglican worship. Okay, so he's saying, look, I'm in charge of the church, I'm in charge of the nation, nobody can buck the system. Thus Charles denounced, deceived, and dissolved successive parliaments between 1625 and 1629. He did this when they refused to vote the loans and taxes he required. As Robertson says in his book, by so doing, he provoked the enmity of a class of powerful men who were ultimately to bring him down, with the help of doctrines forged by the generation of lawyers currently in training at the inns. Inns were associations, places of learning, but it was more than going to a college. It was an association that you had to be a member of in order to study and practice law. So all your barristers, all your judges had to belong to a inn in order to practice law. You had to get accepted and become a member of an inn in order to learn the whole legal process and become a lawyer. Gray's Inn would become even more famous due to the fact that a young man by the name of John Cook was studying law when Charles came to the throne. John Cook was a complete commoner, had no background of royalty, nobility, or wealth, or anything. And the only reason he was able to study law at Gray's Inn was because the inns had begun to flout James I's first law that only nobility could study, only those of high standing could study law. And so they had started to ignore that law, and this young man, John Cook, was able to study law. Now, the famous Puritan preacher, I don't know if you've ever heard of a guy called Richard Sibbes. He was one of the main guys who taught and preached at Gray's Inn. He was the dean of the chapel there, very influential on John Cook, and also influential in his day and still today. His books are still available and much sought after. And so that was the setup at Gray's Inn, and John Cook had sat under Richard Sibbes. And we'll return to Gray's Inn and John Cook at a later time. Now, Charles, in order to try and address the Puritan influence, he wanted to get rid of the Puritans out of England. His father had vowed to eradicate them out of the land. Charles decided not to try and kick them out the land, but just to get them out of the church. And so what he would do would be appoint bishops and people of influence within the church who were anti-Puritan. And so that's how the Puritans would be moved out. They'd be wouldn't be given pastorates and be able to preach, and would be pushed to the sidelines. This plan was headed up by Archbishop William Laud. He was an Arminian who was committed to the rituals like wearing of surplices. A surplice is a covering over your garments when you preach. You put the surplice on. Some people still do it today. They put this robe on, a black robe. You'll see it in some even Presbyterian churches. They all wear that. Originally, my understanding is the idea of it was when you were coming, you know, in the older days, where dress distinguished your class. They wanted the preacher not to be distinguished by class, and so he'd wear a surplice. But then it just became this ritual that didn't really have the meaning, and so the Puritans were against that. This Archbishop Laud also wanted to do the sign, the Roman Catholic sign of baptism, of the cross over the baptism services. He also liked the symbols, like the altar. The altar was very central, and the Puritans stood against that idea, and the stained glass windows, and you know, all this kind of symbolism stuff, things the Puritans couldn't tolerate. Laud also argued that it was mortal sin to disobey the king's command, and exhorted obedience to the king's forced loan, which the king's decree, he had instituted to raise money without the consent of Parliament, taxation without representation. So he couldn't get Parliament to give him the money he needed, and so he brought out this forced loan, as he called it, where he forced people to raise, to give money, and he taxed certain things just arbitrarily. Some MPs were arrested for refusing to pay these new taxes, whereupon they appealed. After being arrested, they appealed to the 29th clause of the Magna Carta. Remember, the Magna Carta was that agreement back in 1215 between King John and your nobles and your church leaders, where they got the king to agree to certain rights and rules and restrictions and controls and checks and balances. And so here, the Magna Carta was an important document in the history, and here these MPs that were being arrested, they appealed to that. And basically what the Magna Carta said, that nobody could be imprisoned without the due process of law, having the charges presented, having a chance to defend themselves, and having the judges and a judgment of their peers to evaluate that and decide. So you can see a lot of the things in our own nation, the court system and the peer judgment and the jury and stuff, has a very long history going back to even 1215 and maybe beyond. The people arguing for the king against these MPs, they argued that these people were imprisoned by the special command of the king, which superseded the Magna Carta. Okay, so we're coming back to that position where the king is above law. He doesn't have to be bound by law. He's not accountable to law. And then the English Attorney General then tampered with the official court roll in order to assert that the king had a royal right to imprison subjects indefinitely without trial for refusing to pay an unlawful tax. So although this tax was unlawful, he had the right to imprison people that wouldn't pay it. And so he tampered with the books. The Attorney General was corrupt, believe it or not. I know we couldn't come to that idea today, but back then they had those kinds of Attorney Generals. I say that with tongue in cheek, by the way. John Cook and others at Gray's Inn circulated writings urging all English freeholders to refuse to pay the forced loan. Judges, however, were completely beholden to the king for their position, and they preferred their own comforts and their calling rather than protecting the liberty of the people, and thus they refused to find fault with the legality of the forced loan taxation. So thus blocked in the courts, the parliament was trying through the courts to deal with this abuse of power, and because they were blocked in the courts, parliament tried another tactic. They said that they would approve a number of new taxes if the king would agree to a petition of rights. It's kind of like bartering with the king. And we'll see what this petition contained, and it's kind of interesting in relation to our history with the King of England. This was in the petition of rights. There was to be no taxation without parliamentary consent. Okay, so no forced billeting of hungry and rapacious soldiers on civilian households. Didn't want that. Keep those soldiers out of our homes. No use by the king of martial law in peacetime. And most importantly, no imprisonment of any man without being charged with anything to which they might make answer according to the law. So I've got to be able to answer my charges. Charles agreed to this, but had no intention of keeping it. He only agreed to that so he could get some money, got his money, and just went on his merry way. Now, when Charles heard that Parliament was preparing to reverse the forced loan, basically what the king taxed was tonnage and poundage, and that was it was an import duty kind of thing. If you bring so much product in, and a lot of the members of Parliament were ship owners and traders and stuff, and so you'd bring the produce in, and you would be taxed. Whether you're shipped by tonnage or the produce by tonnage and poundage, what you bring in, he's just ripping them off. And so they were going to, because of this agreement with the king, no taxation without parliament, that you agreed to the petition, we're now going to remove that you put in place. And when he heard about that, he dissolved parliament, he dissolved the House of Commons and said, it's done, go home, you guys are interfering again. And the king said that in approving the petition of rights, he had not granted new liberties. He had granted no new liberties to them, nor had he agreed to limit his prerogative in any way. The king could tax and imprison as he pleased, irrespective of Magna Carta and common law. So the petition was nothing. It was meaningless. It was this document that really had no authority. In 1629, the king, being desperate for more money, recalled Parliament. But instead of granting more taxes for the King's funds, the House of Commons proceeded to debate three resolutions, pointedly aimed at the King's counsellors and advisers. As I said before, it would have been treason to direct these accusations against the King, and so they directed it against his advisers and his counsellors. These resolutions condemned as capital enemies to the Commonwealth any ministers who should advocate the levy of any tax not approved by Parliament, or who should, like Lord Archbishop Lord, attempt to impose innovation in religion, popery or Arminianism. So you can't do that. Now these three resolutions were presented to Parliament, presented to the Speaker, and said, we want to debate these. The Speaker then brings them to the House, and the House debates. The Speaker at the time was a man by the name of Sir John Finch, and he refused to permit the debate. And he said, I will not say I will not put it to the question, but I must say I dare not. I dare not put it to the question, because he could see this is a challenge of the king, and there's no ways he was prepared to take the brunt of making that stand in Parliament of challenging the king. He's terrified. Although there were laws to protect Parliament, he was terrified to do that. And so Finch then tried to adjourn the meeting by leaving the Speaker's chair. But some MPs rushed up and grabbed him and held him in the chair. And somebody else presented the articles, the resolutions, and they took a vote on it while the king's officers, when they slammed the doors closed and locked them, and the king's officers were trying to break the doors down, banging on the doors, and they took this vote and got the resolutions passed. And so it was, as Robertson says, this was an extraordinary moment in English history. Parliament's most dramatic defiance yet of the sovereign's will and the sovereign's armed officials. But the uniqueness of the occasion really lies in the wording of the resolution. It was the first assertion by Parliament that a capital offence could be committed against the Commonwealth. You could commit a capital offence against the nation. So it could be committed against the Commonwealth in circumstances where the principal offender, albeit immune from justice, would be the sovereign himself. So they're saying the principal offender is the king, although he's immune from the law. So they've taken a step to say we could even point a finger at the king now, although we still can't judge him by the law. The law can't touch him, but we're prepared to accuse him. And so this was a huge shift in the thinking and the understanding as people were wrestling with this. As you can see, Finch said, I don't even want to touch this. I'm not prepared to let the words pass my mouth because of the fear of what would happen. Charles, a few days later, dissolved Parliament and gave a lengthy diatribe against the MPs, his enemies, stating that princes are not bound to give account of their actions but to God alone. I do not have to account for anything except to God, and one day I will stand before God, but until then, I am answerable to no one. He continued saying that this kind of behavior, under pretense of privilege and freedom of speech, was to force us to yield to conditions incompatible with monarchy. So your demands are forcing upon us conditions that cannot be reconciled with monarchy. And meaning what he meant by monarchy there is the absolute divine right of kings. He says you're challenging something that's fundamental to the idea of monarchy. You cannot challenge the divine right of kings. There's no confusion at this stage as to what was at stake. It was very clear that the lines had been drawn and both parties understood what was happening. Charles then had 9 MPs arrested for disorderly conduct in the House for this action when they ran and grabbed Finch and stuff. So they said this was disorderly conduct, it was violence, it was against just ways of behaving. It's funny how such people use the law. And one judge initially ruled in favor of the MPs who claimed parliamentary privileges, but the king ignored the court ruling and had the men imprisoned in the Tower of London where they were at his mercy. What the king wanted was an apology and an admission of guilt. A man by the name of Elliot and 4 other MPs out of the 9, so 5 out of the 9, refused to grovel and remained in prison for over a year. When the case finally came to the court, the judges knew that the words of the MPs spoken in Parliament could not be punished in the courts. This was something that dated back to the first Parliament under Queen Elizabeth. They understood that you can say anything in Parliament and you cannot be held accountable for that, in the sense of that you said something wrong against the king. So that had been in place for many, many years. The MPs argued that only Parliament, as the highest court, could discipline its members, and claimed that privilege in the opposite way, they claimed that privilege in the appropriate way of not responding to the charge. They said, we're not even going to respond to the charge because we have nothing to answer. You cannot bring a charge against a parliamentarian debate. There's nothing to answer. And so they refused to plea. And so in consequence to this, the duty of the judge was to investigate their claim and indeed to uphold it. And nobody doubted its validity, the validity of the freeness of Parliament to debate as they wished. But the judges, instead of doing this, they decided to treat the refusal to plead not as a claim of privilege, but as a refusal to acknowledge the court. And a refusal to recognize the court meant that the defendant's silence, when called upon to answer the charge, must be taken as a confession of guilt. So that's how they rule. This is no privilege, this is guilt. And by this device, and after one judge had been suspended by the king because he wanted to uphold parliamentary privilege, the coward bench contrive to uphold the king's behavior and to find the MPs guilty. They were heavily fined and imprisoned at the king's pleasure. And Charles was not pleased to release any of them without an unqualified apology, and was particularly pleased when Elliot died in the Tower from consumption. His death was hastened by the king's refusal to allow a fire in his cell. And so this brave man, John Elliot, was Parliament's first martyr, a man who disdained to save his own life by the expedience of an insincere apology. He refused to apologize for what he had done. At this time, the Puritans in Parliament could not conceive of England ruled by other than a king. This is how they thought. It's still going to be a king. All we're asking for, all we're fighting for, all we want was that we should govern with the wisdom of, he should govern with the wisdom of Parliament and under the restriction of common law. That's all we want. Let's be bound by law. They stood for Parliament's place alongside the king. They stood for its right to consent to any taxes on the class of its members composed. They stood on the right to influence the king's foreign policy in a Europe beset by popery, and also to ensure that he kept the faith, the Protestant faith, preferably purged of rituals and observances. So they said, we've got these responsibilities to do. And obviously the king was very opposed to those positions and that idea. Charles was incensed at this and dissolved Parliament and entered upon 11 years of personal rule from 1629 to 1640. He reigned free of all irritations and provocations from people like Sir John Elliot and his colleagues. This dissolution of Parliament was seen by many to be the true cause of the Civil War. The King's actions in 1629, when he dissolved Parliament and reigned for 11 years, basically made the Civil War inescapable. And so that's where Charles is up to at that point, and he reigns until 1640, that puts us right into the midst of the Westminster Confession. It puts us into the midst of Lex Rex as we come up to that period. But we can see the struggle and the wrestling of these people as they're trying to deal with theological positions that they had not yet been able to think through and arrive at conclusions with. This tradition of the divine right of king was a huge stumbling block to get over. But you've got God raising up in the ranks significant men that understood Scripture, that were prepared to stand on Scripture and die for Scripture. And so that's what's now going to be developing as we'll come back to really the actions that will include the actual civil war itself and the ramifications as that wound down and brought us to the arrest of Charles I. And that produced a whole lot of more problems as to what do we do now with the arrested king. And so it's a great legal debate. It's a great identification of the struggles of Christians struggling to arrive at truth. It's not something that just sometimes comes easily. And the Lord puts us through turmoil, and even as we lose the truth and we forget about the battles that we've had in the past, and we come with new battles, we brought back to these times of wrestling and struggling with the truth to say, hey, how are we supposed to think and act in these days? And so that is what's going to confront us more and more as we continue in our study of the English Civil War.